Welcome to episode 15 of the Serious About Security podcast for Tuesday, September 4th, 2012, brought to you by the Greater Lafayette Security Professionals Group, Secure Purdue, and the Center for Education and Research in Information Assurance and Security, or SIRIUS, at Purdue University. Let me introduce the host of today's podcast. I'm Preston Wiley, CISSP, CCNA.
This is Keith Watson, Research Engineer at SIRIUS.
And I'm Mike Hill, CISSP. In announcements today, the next Greater Lafayette Security Professionals meeting will be on Thursday, September 13th. It will be a workshop using Metasploit to probe for vulnerabilities in virtual environments. Please be sure to bring along your laptop and lunch, and we'll see you there.
The Fall SIRIUS Security Seminar is in full swing. On September 5th, Ed Lopez from Fortinet will be presenting. On September 12th, we'll have someone from Deloitte & Touche. These seminars begin at 4:30 p.m. in Steward Center G52 and are also shown on the Purdue channel in the Greater Lafayette area. These seminars are recorded and made available as podcasts and on YouTube. Information is available at the SIRIUS website, www.CERIIS.purdue.edu.
In news this podcast, we have a few security updates. Mozilla Firefox 15 was released that corrected 7 critical and 6 high vulnerabilities on August 28th, and at the same time, Thunderbird 15 was also released that corrected 5 critical and 4 high vulnerabilities. A very important update to Java was released by Oracle as an emergency patch, which corrected several critical vulnerabilities that were being widely exploited in the wild. And Oracle says that all Java users should immediately update to the new version. The update is only for, I think, Linux and Windows, and does not, I don't think the exploit was exploitable on the Mac OS X environment. And we'll move on to articles. The first article is about the Java exploit, which, according to a security researcher, the Oracle knew about this exploit since April, and it wasn't patched until recently. Java mentioned that they were going to release a patch for it in October on their standard release cycle, but wide exploitability of it, and it was being used to distribute malware and stuff, kind of forced them to release an emergency patch for it. So I think it's a kind of a concern that it takes so long to patch Java, essentially, and this exploit was known about, and according to the security researcher, it was probably discovered independently. There was no leak or anything like that of the patch, because according to him, the way that the exploits were used were not in a way that he used them, but they did use the exploits that he discovered and reported. So what do you guys think about the delay, essentially, in Oracle getting the news of these exploits and then them releasing them, having been required to release an emergency patch because these exploits were being used maliciously?
Well, I guess my thought on this is, you know, they seem like they rolled out the emergency patch in a quick fashion once they discovered that it was being exploited in the wild, you know, that people were using this. So I kind of wonder what the benefits are in delaying. You know, I can see where maybe they don't want to bring the bad press, the bad attention, and you know, back in April, you know, mention, hey, by the way, we have this vulnerability. So I can kind of see why they may have wanted to just kind of include this in their regular update cycle and kind of just build it into changes that come along. But then again, it seemed like they were able to turn around quickly and distribute an emergency patch. And I guess I would want to err on the side of safety. You know, if I, You know, the thing I don't know when you read these articles and you come across these things is this a common everyday thing? I mean, this security researcher said I made them aware of it, but were they made aware of 100 vulnerabilities in April? Were they made aware of 1,000? Were they made aware of 3? You know, if it's on a small scale, I would think that you would want to roll out emergency patches as quickly as possible and catch this thing before it can be exploited. But if they're getting a large number of these things and, you know, they're having to kind of stop new development to address all these things, I could see where maybe they're kind of like, well, hey, we'll just build this into some development we're already doing and we'll just roll it up into a new release. So it does concern me that, you know, they knew about this in April and didn't plan on doing anything about it until October. That's a big window of opportunity for these things to be discovered, and it was exploited. So now they had to turn around and release an emergency patch. So my thought on it is, if they're getting a small number of these reports, and we're talking about Oracle Java here specifically, but I think, you know, for any company, you know, if you're getting a small number of these, why not just release an emergency patch and get something out there to stop and say, we were made aware of this. Here's a quick fix, and our next full release will take care of it and more things that will be coming. So, that's kind of my opinion is, I would like to know why they waited to release an emergency patch. I think it's kind of obvious they did it once it was being exploited, but what would have, you know, why delay, and you know, what would have been the harm in rolling out a patch back in April or May? You know, if they would have done one at that time and said it's not been exploited, but we want to make sure it doesn't get exploited, what would have been the disadvantage in doing it at that point?
Okay, well, I used to work for a company known as Sun, which has been subsumed by a company known as Oracle. And so, having dealt with some of these issues as a product manager for Solaris, I can address some of the issues that Mike mentions. And usually when you have a large programming group, you have your development team, which is working on new code. You have a sustaining team, or that was the term typically used by Sun, sustaining. That was the group that handled any updates, patches to existing code bases. So they would address problems with hardware drivers, or they'd address issues with security. They'd address all sorts of issues, even documentation issues. That team is typically understaffed, and typically when a sustaining engineer gets really good at what they do, they get promoted to the development side. And so sustaining engineering teams, or those that address support issues in large projects, typically are understaffed, overworked, and they also have a budget. Part of that budget deals with the release of updates. So they want to find the balance that not only in time and money makes the most sense for them from a business perspective. So some of the issues that go into this are, yes, they do get a lot of bug reports. Some of those bug reports are duplicates. Some of those bug reports are a one-off case that are very hard to replicate, those sorts of issues, right? Sometimes they have to make decisions on what are we going to pick, you know, but they have to take all these reports that come in and decide which ones are legitimate bugs, which ones are just user error, which ones are documentation error, which ones are duplicates, which ones are all these sorts of issues. They have to sort those out, and then they have to create piles of them and figure out which ones need to be addressed right away, which ones don't need to be addressed at all. Some of these are reports that come in, the security issue with this particular piece of software, and they make an attempt. And sometimes they are legitimately serious security issues, but they don't appear to be from the bug report. That can be the case sometimes. Sometimes when somebody reports the bug, they don't, through their own disclosure philosophy or whatever, they don't say, well, I reported it to Oracle, and I'm going to go to the press now and report this. Sometimes that's not what we would call responsible reporting. Some people don't go to the vendor in the first place. You know, they just announce this problem that they've discovered, right? But there's this challenge of trying to figure out which bugs are going to be important to fix right away, which ones can you delay, and can you put it in your release cycle? Because when you release a patch or an update out of band, that's a significant cost. But there's also this PR side to it as well, right? How bad are we going to look in the press if we don't address these issues? The sustaining team doesn't worry about that. The marketing team typically worries about that. And so they're evaluating their brand awareness. They're evaluating the perception in the market, and they're helping make some of these decisions. Also, the legal team is also involved with this. So at some point, these issues bubble up in the press, and then the issue has to be addressed. Now, it could be that they did have the patch in the existing code base ready to go in the next update that is part of their release cycle, or it could be that they hadn't gotten to it yet. We don't actually know the answer to that. If it were part of their regular release cycle update, then they might be able to backport that fix to just create a one-off patch, right? There's a significant amount of cost to that to do that, but it's still possible to do. The other part is it's not going to get the same amount of testing, most likely. And so sometimes when you create a patch, you create problems, unforeseen at the time, and that can only be found through testing and through integration testing and unit testing, all that sort of stuff. And if you create a patch to address a security issue, but you actually break the software, that's another PR disaster right there. So there's a little challenge that these companies have to do. Good sustaining teams have a process to do this very quickly and can automate some of this. Some other groups, maybe not so well. We don't know all the issues associated with what Oracle did. Certainly, when you get an issue like this reported to you and you don't take it seriously until later, or you don't think it's going to be an issue, it might be a medium-type vulnerability until somebody figures out how to exploit it, then it becomes critical. And so some of that may have changed down the stream as more became aware of this and more ability to exploit that became possible. Now, if you look at some of the vendors like Microsoft, for example, they have this whole process of rating different vulnerabilities based on how accessible exploit code is, what the level of damage that can be done, and what technical skill is required to do that. And that figures into a formula that tells them what they need to work on right away. I don't know that Oracle has that. They've never talked about that. So we don't really know all of these issues. But certainly it doesn't look good for a vendor to come out later and issue an emergency update for software because their software is being actively exploited. But I wanted to bring some perspective from what I've seen from these larger software teams as to why this may have occurred. I'm not saying that it's a good thing, but that might be some of the issues associated with why the delay happened.
Well, I also wanted to point out that from what Mike said, apparently there was a total of 29 reported vulnerabilities that were reported at the same time, and they did have a release cycle, patch cycle since that the reporting, and apparently they only fixed 3 of the 29 that were reported, and Oracle said they were planning on to release a total of 19, fixed 19 more in the October cycle. So that still would leave some unpatched, apparently, from ones that were reported in April. But again, we don't know the severity level of these 29 discovered vulnerabilities and how exploitable they are. But, I mean, the other question is every 4 months enough for a Java? I mean, this is a widely deployed web, usable on the web. Pretty much all web browsers have plugins for this, and typically people do have Java installed for one reason or another. For such a widely deployed web architecture, is every 4 months responsible, essentially, from Oracle's standpoint? And I mean, Adobe has a quarterly release cycle, and they consistently are releasing patches outside of their quarterly release cycle. And Java or Oracle doesn't do this very often at all. So, but you know, you could argue that it's not quite as exploited as Flash and the other Adobe solutions. So is every 4 months responsible?
I think from the enterprise perspective, which is what Oracle started out as, right? Definitely an enterprise company. They didn't sell to consumers. A quarterly patch cycle made sense at the time. And in fact, I believe that 12, 13 years ago, Oracle is one of the companies who said, we are going to go to a quarterly patch cycle. And several other companies followed suit. And they did it mostly for cost savings and for customer benefit, because customers could expect patches at a regular interval. And so they could prepare for it. Because when you have an enterprise-level database, you can't just turn it off one night, update it a little bit, and turn it back on and hope it works again. There's a lot of planning and testing that has to go in before you do that. And so by putting it on a quarterly patch cycle, that's why they did that. But it also saved them money because they knew when they had to release. The problem is that Oracle, by its acquisition of Sun, also an enterprise company, but has this little division called Java, which is in every consumer device pretty much known to man these days. Now they're dealing with a much larger customer base, and they're still treating it with an enterprise perspective. And I think that's part of the challenge and one thing they've not done well yet.
Yes, and I would agree with that. As you illustrated, it's a different market. And I think in this case, in my opinion, for Java updates alone, at least, I would like to see it kind of go to a monthly patch cycle, kind of like what Microsoft's doing with Patch Tuesday, indicate, make it Patch Wednesday, Patch Monday, maybe ride on Microsoft's coattails. But clearly, it's a big target. And the ability for them to get patches out in a quicker fashion, I think would alleviate some of these issues for them if they could have a quicker turnaround. I think it would help them from a PR perspective. The other thing I'm just going to note, I find it a bit disturbing, though I'm not blaming any programmers, but the way the world functions now, the way software functions, is we're not really surprised by the number of bugs, and it's more like how many and how vulnerable are they. The software that comes out, it just seems like they can be exploited in so many different ways, and it's just kind of disheartening to me as a software developer, because you try your, I think everyone tries their best to put out a great product, and then there's all these different vectors and all these things that are found. I mean, some of these are, just human errors, and the other things are the software being used in a way that no one ever anticipated. But, I think a quarterly patch cycle for a product like Java is outdated, because these things come up quickly, and I don't think it's reasonable, with as widely deployed as it is, to say, we're going to take care of that, and 3 months from now we'll patch that. That'll be part of the next patch cycle. I think that's unreasonable. I think a month is more reasonable, and really, I wouldn't even mind seeing some, out of cycle updates in that case. If necessary, have it out within a couple weeks. Now I know that puts a burden on products and getting them out and getting patches made available. But I think if they want to take a strong security stance, that's part of what they're going to have to look into doing. Because I don't think you can just let, I don't think it's reasonable to say, here's a vulnerability and we're going to wait 3 months for it to be patched. That's, in my mind, that's just too much time.
I think part of the problem is that the software update mechanism is also a little flawed in the Java system. And Adobe's Flash recently has gone to a model where it checks automatically, where previously you had to know when it was time to update it and you had to manually do that. Now it's a little more automated, and thanks to it being bundled in Chrome, for example, when Chrome updates, you get a new update of Flash as well. I don't see that happening yet with other types of software frameworks, but Java itself is a bit dated, and it's Java applets seem a little dated themselves too. So I'm not sure how much longer, I'm sure everybody probably has that one website or something that they have to use for their job that requires Java applets. I'm kind of in that boat. It's just one thing that I can't get around. that I have to have Java enabled for. But if I didn't have that, it would be gone, and I would not have to worry about having Java applets anymore. You know, hopefully I'll get to that day. But until then, we're kind of stuck with it.
All right, well, we'll move on to the second article, which is Keith's.
Yeah, this one addresses an issue that we've talked about in previous episodes about Dropbox. And if you recall, Dropbox had an issue where originally we thought that because of their login page, it would let you know whether or not your email address that you'd entered as your login identifier was correct or not. And it was suspected that that may have been the source of people getting a hold of email addresses that were then using it for spam. Then Dropbox did a little investigation and claimed that one of their employees had a password stolen from them, and that that password was used to access one of the systems that contained a large number of the login names, and then that was what became the source of the problem. Anyways, to counter that, Dropbox talked about a couple security measures, and one of the security measures they mentioned were adding two-step verification to the service. And that's currently available in kind of a alpha, maybe beta mode, and it's not listed as one of the features on their security page. So if you sign into your Dropbox account on the web, it's not actually a link or a feature that you can add currently. They're still doing some testing for that. And so they've made this available, and if you want to enable it with your Dropbox account, you can do that. You can go to the Dropbox.com site /try_2-factor. And that will then, you'll go through the process of enabling two-factor verification on your account. The nice thing here is that they're using some existing technology to do this. They didn't go off and invent some two-step verification type system. They actually adopted an RFC-based system on time-based one-time passwords. And the client that you can use is available on Windows phones. It's available as a command line tool. It's available in a form on Android called the Google Authenticator, and also available on iOS as well. And what they do is when you enable it, it displays a QR code that you can then photograph with your mobile device that will then send the secret key and some other details to your authenticator tool, which will then save that information so that you can access it later. And that will then generate a 6-digit number every 30 seconds that is based on the secret key in the current time, and display a code that you then enter into the website, and then that's how you access your account. Currently, it does not work with the clients. So if you have Dropbox clients on your computer or your phone, they're not currently asking for that. Now, also keep in mind that once you've linked a device, you don't have to enter your authentication details again, although you can go and unlink that device from the website. So it's currently, it's out there, it's ready for people to try out. It's not quite ready for use every day, I think mostly because their clients don't require it yet. That's one factor. But they are, according to the forums, releasing a 1.5 version of the client, which is kind of incorporating perhaps some of the two-step verification features. And so at some point that may become no longer optional. It may be a feature that any user can turn on, and then the clients will also support that capability as well. So it kind of addresses that issue, and they didn't invent a new thing to do it, which is kind of nice, because I could just take my current Google Authenticator tool and just add that in to my existing Google account, two-step verification. That works quite well. The other thing that's interesting is they have a backup code. So if you want to turn off your two-step verification because, say, you've lost your phone or you've lost the key or whatever, and you need to get into your Dropbox account, there is a 16-digit backup code that you can then enter that will then allow you to turn off two-step verification. So if somebody did get access to your web account when you were still logged in and attempted to turn it off, they would not be able to without that code. Of course, that's a little cumbersome to ask somebody to have a 16-digit code, but they do say write it down and keep it somewhere safe. And as always, for your backup codes, it's a good idea, but it might not be something you have handy with you. So just keep that in mind. And of course, this may change because this is still in development.
Well, I think it's a great step forward for Dropbox. I would love to see, you know, all sites support two-step verification. I think it really does increase the security. And I think you touched on a lot of the items, Keith, in that right now it's really just for accessing your account through the web. On the client side, there's still no additional step there. I have enabled it within Dropbox just to try it out. And I think it's great. You know, you do log in, you can kind of remove your clients that way. So, I mean, that's maybe one of the biggest keys is, you know, whenever you want to add new devices, you really do need to be able to go in and, you know, authorize that and log in. And by having that two-step verification, not only do you have to have then the password that goes with the Dropbox account, but you have to have that six-digit code. And as you already mentioned, you know, you can use the Google Authenticator or you can have it sent as a text message. So I'm very pleased to see Dropbox adopting this. And I'm curious to see, you know, I'm not sure how elegant it'll work on the client side, but I'm eager to see if they're going to come up with a way to do that. I mean, I do have Dropbox on an iPhone, along with where the authenticator, where I would get the code. So is it a matter of, you know, I have to, you know, using the same device, I get the code and then I turn around and plug that into the client. So I think there's some interesting, they may have some interesting challenges as they try to adapt it for all the clients. But I do think it's a really great thing. And you mentioned the 16-character code that you could use to get into your account if you need to disable it or if you, for some reason, don't have access to your phone or the authenticator. And I just wanted to mention a great place to store that, as we mentioned a few episodes back, is a password safe. And that's where I keep mine. I just keep it there with my password so that I can get back to it. So I'm really in trouble if I lose access to the safe because not only will I not know my password, but I won't know my 16-character code either. But I do keep that in a secure location. I keep it backed up. So.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how this evolves, essentially. I think it's in its early stages, and I imagine they will find other ways to kind of get back your access once you lose it if you happen to lose your 16-digit backup code and your phone or something like that. And I imagine maybe something like, oh, you have access to your Dropbox, we'll put a file in it, you know, to verify that you actually already have access to your Dropbox account or something like that. And they can verify that a file exists within your Dropbox. And so you already technically have access to it from a computer, so you can restore, you know, access or something like that. I mean at the moment I think it's not quite, I don't think the way they do it is really up to the standard Dropbox user. I think this is definitely a beta test, and I think they're going to have to maybe add a little bit more user-friendly stuff to it, because people do tend to lose things, especially when it comes to their phones and things like that. So I think it's in its early stages, and I'm interested to see what they do with it.
The one thing it doesn't do that the Google version does is they give you a choice between getting SMS codes as your authentication or using the other, but not both. And so on the Google side, you can actually say, I will enter my code, or I need to get a code from SMS. And that's the one difference there. The other thing I'll point out is Facebook also has a one-time password system, which is integrated to their mobile app. So if you sign into your Facebook account on your mobile device, it will, and you enter your username and password, it will then send you a message saying you will receive an SMS code within the next minute, which is only sent to your registered cell phone that you have with Facebook. And so it's kind of interesting because when you sign in and then within a few seconds you get an SMS code, and on my Android device it shows up on the status bar and I can just type the code in right there and I'm good to go. So that's the Facebook method. They don't actually use like a Google Authenticator to do it. They just focus on SMS codes, which works pretty well if you've used the service and have that enabled. So we shall see how this turns out with the Dropbox one.
Yeah, and I'll just comment on one other thing that was mentioned. User friendliness of two-factor authentication. I've seen some complaints on, you know, it's one extra step, and you know, I'll admit it's a little extra step, it's a little bit more hassle, but it's not that much. I mean, once you really start using it and getting used to it, I mean, I don't go, you know, I don't just leave my, I'm not away from my phone, especially if I'm away from the home. You know, I have my phone with me, so if I'm needing to do something, I've got the phone right there. And you know, I think it's pretty slick the way it works. And I know that some people are very hesitant, and that's part of, I think, what's made everyone kind of slow to adopt it is it's not very friendly. But I think as we see, now we're seeing more major sites really adopt this. I think once people get used to using it on one or two sites, it won't be difficult to kind of start using it everywhere. It's more of a, you know, it's kind of more of a mindset, kind of back when, you know, passwords used to be whatever you wanted to make them, and it could be, you know, two characters, you know, early on. Now it's very difficult to go anywhere where you can kind of set up a password that's less than 8 characters. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, 2 to 5 years down the road, if we're not going to see many sites, you know, even your typical everyday site where if you have an account, you have to have this extra piece of information, this second factor to get into the account. And I think as that starts to happen, then you might actually begin to see some sites that will actually force it. But yeah, to my knowledge right now, that's not happening. So it'll be interesting, and this will be something to watch.
Well, I think the fatal flaw, I'll say, with two-factor authentication is how do you recover from losing that second factor? And that's, I think that's the issue with user friendliness and all that. It's not the user friendliness necessarily of the two-factor authentication. That is an issue, but I think it's the user friendliness of what happens when I lose my two-factor, and that's an issue. In that, if you make it too easy, then there's two-factor authentication is pretty pointless, and if you make it too hard, then you know people are hesitant to use their two-factor authentication because they're concerned. Well, if I lose my second factor, then I lose complete access to my account. And like with Dropbox right now, it seems to me that if you lose that 16-character recovery ID, then you lose access to your account. Now, I may be wrong. You may be able to call in, give them some information. They will restore access to you from the web or whatever. But I think that is an issue with two-factor authentication, is that thing that you have. If you lose that thing you have, then what do you do? On an enterprise level, you can go to your administrators and they can, like, you can stand in front of them and prove who you are. But for a large company, you know, they have to somehow, there has to be some way to recover from that.
Yeah, and that's a very good point. And that's kind of the Achilles heel of it all is, like you said, if you make it too easy, then two-factor authentication is pointless. It's not adding anything to it. And if you make it too hard, if you make it too difficult, then people are less likely to use it. So I am curious to see what Dropbox will come up with. You know, obviously the dialing in and giving them some information like the last 4 digits of your credit card, for example, may not be the best way to go. As we talked about previously, Matt Honan, you know, his account got compromised using a social engineering technique kind of similar to that, where, you know, that piece of information, you know, the hackers were able to determine. So, you know, I don't have a great answer for that yet. You know, I'm curious to see what will come, you know, what will come down the road. You know, it makes me wonder if there's some way that you can use the one piece of information they have to somehow give them some legitimacy. So if they know their password and they're able to provide their password, is there some other method that could be added onto that that would then allow them to disable the two-factor, you know, the code that they need? And if vice versa, if they are able to get the code without the password, there's some other technique they'd be able to go into. But I just, you know, I don't know an easy way at this point. So, you know, I don't think calling in is necessarily the best thing either, because people can imitate, you know. I mean, what do you tie it to? Do you say, well, can you tell me what your mobile number was that the codes were going to that you lost? Well, yeah, I can tell you what that was. You know, I can give you that information. Well, okay, we're going to disable two-factor for you. So that, you know, that's sort of that's a challenge that I see to be ongoing, and maybe somewhere along the line something will come along that makes that easier. But if that's the case, that might become the sole source of authentication of the future. So I don't know. I'm kind of lost on that one.
All right. Well, we'll move on to the next article, which is Mike's.
Yeah. So the final article of the day is on is by Toyota. They are actually suing a former IT contractor that was fired on August 23rd. The IT contractor was fired that day, and then that night at midnight, he logged onto their system for about 6.5 hours and was copying and saving off data and printing. They believe he was printing trade secrets. I believe he was also changing things to kind of sabotage them as well. Or they believe that he may have done some of those items as well. So they are, suing him for the damages that he has caused, and believe he is an Indian citizen, and they, because of this lawsuit, he has to stay within the United States until all of this is cleared up. Now, the one thing that's not clear in the articles that I've seen is whether or not the IT contractor had his privileges revoked after he was fired. Everything I've found only says that he accessed the system after he was fired. So, you know, there's a couple scenarios that could have played out. He could have been fired but not had his account revoked or his permissions changed or account locked out. And then that night, he may have been disgruntled and decided that he wanted to retaliate against Toyota and logged into their supplier website and started kind of wreaking some of this havoc. That's one possible scenario. The other scenario is that, you know, when he was fired, his account was disabled and everything was revoked, but he may have had access to different accounts, or he may have had a back door into the system for him to be able to go in and do some of these things. What I thought was interesting about this article and was good to bring up for the podcast is kind of the review on what companies should do and, you know, whether they're big or small when an employee is fired, what kind of policies they should have in place. I believe some of the recommended practices are, especially in the event that an employee or a contractor is being fired, is that pretty much as you're walking them out the door, you've shut off access to all their accounts. You've locked them out essentially, so they cannot get back into any of those accounts. So I don't know in this case. I have not been able to find enough information yet that says whether or not Toyota revoked his account access and he circumvented it after he was fired and had another way to get into the system, or whether this was a matter of they fired him but they didn't change his account privileges and he was able to access the system and essentially steal data and change data on a live production site that could potentially do a lot of damage to Toyota. So I just wanted to kind of get your thoughts on this. What do you think, what could a company like Toyota do in this case to protect themselves from this type of incident?
It was pointed out that he was not a Toyota employee and that he was actually worked for an outsourcing firm. And so his loyalty to the company was probably zero, obviously. So there's a big debate whether, you know, having outsourcing some of your operations is a wise idea, and I think that debate will go on for years to come. So that's one issue. The other is that the complaint used the word, or at least the article used the word, hacked into the Toyotasupplier.com site. That seems to indicate that his access might have been revoked, or it might indicate that the journalists were taking liberty with the facts, or the indictment, or the complaint filed in court used an improper term that may be that he did have access. They just had not gotten around to terminating that access. So your question about what can they do? One is have these procedures in place to make sure access is removed. The other problem there is he may have created a backdoor into the system. And we've seen many instances where system administrators have created time bombs or logic bombs that would go off if they were fired or if they didn't do certain activities that the system would assume they'd been fired and then take destructive action or something like that or open up holes. Or he may have known of weaknesses and just exploited them or left weaknesses in the system so that he could exploit them. We don't really know. You're right. There's not enough information. But even if he had lost his access and created a backdoor for himself, that's a problem. And that's a difficult problem to solve in a lot of cases because we put a lot of trust in our system administrators. And sometimes they may create these backdoors, logic bombs, time bombs that go off when you least expect them to. So some of that is there needs to be kind of, you know, two-person control over some things. There needs to be review of information. One technique that we don't see a lot these days is kind of like forced vacation, where you send the person out the door for a little while, and then their accounts are reviewed and their access is reviewed, and some of their activities are reviewed. We don't see that much anymore. It's a very intensive sort of activity to do, and it's maybe not seen as being something that companies can do in a lot of cases too, but certainly those are some issues there. But you know, there's a loyalty issue here, which is even when you have regular employees, the loyalty issue comes into play as well. You can have certainly full-time employees that do not act in the company's best interests at all times. And so this is not a unique challenge, but it is a significant challenge for a lot of these larger organizations.
Yeah, and I'll just touch on the fact that you pointed out that he was an IT contractor and not a direct employee of Toyota. I have worked in some positions as a contractor to a large company, and what's interesting is they had designed it so that as a contractor, our level of access was much more restricted than that of a direct employee. So I find it really interesting in this case whether, you know, one of the things that came to mind as I was reading the article initially was, you know, did he exceed his privilege level, or was he just given a higher privilege level than he should have had as a contractor in the first place? It seems to me that, and I can't speak to Toyota's process here. Maybe they have something like this in place already. You know, that the contractors would probably kind of check stuff into an area or kind of work in this holding area that where then a Toyota employee would probably say, yeah, let's go ahead and push this over and make this change effective or not effective. You know, that's one scenario I've been in the past is that, you know, there's kind of this review process, kind of built-in review process where the contractors kind of have their stuff looked at a little differently than a direct employee. I don't know that it makes a ton of difference here. I just wanted to point out that there are some scenarios where contractors kind of have more scrutiny. So in this case, you know, I'm more curious than anything. Did Toyota have a process like that in place, and this individual is still able to kind of circumvent it? I mean, it's not impossible, even if they had kind of someone working with them and working with these contractors, it's not impossible to think that he may have found an exploit and found a way to get around it, anyway. But it's one of those things that they definitely, you know, everyone kind of needs to be aware of. The other thing was, you know, kind of the process for when you do let someone go, making sure that all of that stuff is kind of cut off immediately, that all their privileges are removed instantly. So we'll have, you know, I'm curious to see what else will come out of this, but there's definitely, it definitely seemed like this contractor had a high level of access, whether, you know, the thing that's the part that's unclear is whether he was authorized to have that much access, or if he was able to kind of through back doors or circumventing or kind of manipulating the software, whether he was able to obtain that over a course of time.
Well, the article mentions that he stole information, claims of it made that he sabotaged software and caused computers to crash. So it seems to me like if he was able to do that, he would have some pretty high level access in order to be able to sabotage software and cause computers to crash. Now, if he was given that access or if he exploited something is we don't know, and they're just claims. They're not necessarily that he actually did it. I mean, all of this is he's alleged to do this, and I believe that the complaint that Toyota filed was a criminal complaint. I don't think it was a civil complaint because they said he illegally did stuff. So that to me that kind of implies that it was a criminal complaint. The article doesn't actually say that, but I'm guessing that they're trying to, you know, get him on criminal charges, and they might also sue him. I mean, they say that the stuff that he stole will cause immediate and irreparable damage to them. So, you know, the price is, you know, is very high. So, I think they just want, they want him to answer for basically what he's done and prevent this from happening in the future. But I mean, obviously some of their process probably is to blame as well.
Yeah, and I you know, I read that in the article as well, and I think this is where words can kind of have, you know, kind of dual meanings. I think that's why it's so difficult to tell, because to me, I think you could still say he illegally accessed the site if he was fired, regardless of if his account was disabled or his password had been changed or whatnot. If he was fired and no longer associated with the project, then I think and I don't know this for sure, but I think it's one of those things where, you know, you should not be accessing the site. So if you're accessing the site, even though maybe they didn't prevent him, it would still be an illegal access. I'm not saying that, you know, it's very likely that he did have all those privileges removed, but I think it would still be considered illegal even if he had not, because his role had changed. He was no longer associated with the company and should not be going into that site. So if he went into that site and started doing stuff, then I believe it would be considered illegal access. And again, as you mentioned, it's really speculating on whether or not he had the privilege level to go and cause that kind of damage, or whether or not he hacked the system and did things to elevate his level of permission. Honestly, neither scenario would surprise me. I do think there are some situations where individuals are given more permission than they need, and you know, they're trusted to do just what they need to do. But it's easier just to give them this additional level, just in case they ever need to go and do something else. Or there's scenarios where maybe they need access to it, but 99% of the time they don't. You know, so my takeaway from reading the article was this is a good opportunity to review your own policies and procedures and account access, and see that the employees and contractors you have the appropriate level of permissions, and that in the event that they are terminated or leave, that you have a process in place that removes that level of access in a timely manner.
All right, and with that, we'll wrap up the show. I wanted to thank Keith Watson and Mike Hill, as well as Sirius and Secure Purdue. I'm Preston Wiley. Have a safe and secure day.